Our guest today is Mr. Bashiru Sheikh, aka Bashir Lai. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Coffee, for hosting me.
You're welcome. You're most welcome. I'm just going to go through a little bit about yourself, your biography, and then we'll jump into some questioning. Thank you for taking time to join us on this podcast today.
My pleasure.
So, Mr. Bashiru Sheikh, aka Bashir Lai, is an UCAT Sheikh Atta Diop University of Dakar graduate with a BA in English with a concentration on American civilization and literature. He worked for almost 10 years at Child Fund Senegal as a sponsor relationship supervisor, in-house translator or interpreter, and local funding officer. Currently, Mr. Bashir is the CEO of CPN, a pioneering West African public-private partnership based in Dakar, Senegal. And recently he has been appointed chief advisor to the Office of Special Envoy of the Republic of Sierra Leone, Ambassador Walid Shamsid Dean, and represents the interest of many Muslim and African-American businesses. His cultural competences and connections at the highest level of West African government with businesses, social and religious leaders have enabled him to actively engage in bridging the gap between Africans on the continent and people of African descent, especially those in the USA over the last 25 years. His actions embraces sectors, including foreign direct investment, culture, education, knowledge and technology transfer, tourism, and many others. His vision is to inform policies and aid decision makers to give articles of power to credible and most outstanding people among people of African descent, especially African Americans, so that they will have the authority to work with and within American government and beyond. As an international advisor, he has facilitated and hosted a high-level delegation from many organizations such as NMBC, National Muslim Business Council, The Collective, NABAA, and Supreme Foundation, etc. He is also very active in interfaith dialogue and worked as an advisor to many religious leaders in West Africa. And we're going to get into that later on during this podcast. Welcome again, Mr. Bashir.
Thank you. Thank you, Kofi. Thank you.
All right. So I'd like to focus in improving lives of Africans and people of Afro heritage in our community, in Africa, in the diaspora, just globally. Okay, we'll talk about social, political, and corporate engagements as well. So let's talk about your successful work at Child Fund International. So Child Fund International focuses on the assistance to children facing poverty and many other challenges, such as lack of protection and starvation worldwide. Your focus was mostly in Africa. What has been the strategy in helping children in Africa through Child Fund? And also, what was your personal experience knowing the great change you were bringing to the continent of Africa in vulnerable communities in your role as the sponsor, supervisor, and translator?
Thank you. Thank you, Kofi. First of all, I would like just to add something on my bio, which was not really adequately updated. Over the last 1.5, 2 years, I've been hosting conferences throughout America, the United States, talking to people, especially African Americans, you know, on how they can, you know, make themselves ready when they want to come back on the continent of Africa and how they can come back home, not empty-handed, but really useful for themselves, their community, and also the continent. So I've been hosting conferences at Jackson, Mississippi, North Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia. Like last year, I was in Delaware and in Philadelphia and so on. So working at Child Fund International was a very exciting and challenging, but also inspiring experience. Because as a sponsor research supervisor, I had to oversee about 12,000 children in Senegal, in the Gambia, and in Sierra Leone, in what we call child and family development programs. As you know, Child Fund International is a sponsorship, based organization, which means that actually for each child, you have to enroll and create a little story we call child information folder, which is just in the form of an open letter to attract sponsors in the US or elsewhere in the world. And then those sponsors will come up there to make a pledge and commit to contributing on a monthly basis at least $20,000, you know, a month. And all that money now it gathered and will be the budget of One Child and Family Program, which we call CFP. So, and, you know, in Africa, the governments, they don't have enough resources to, you know, provide adequately for the people. And this is where NGO, like Child Fund, you know, comes in, okay, to just come and sign what we call a headquarters agreement with the government of Senegal to establish and start doing the work. Now, this is really inspiring, simply because when you have over like 1,000 people in One Child and Family Development Program, so you provide them with adequate education, health care, but also guidance, but you also make sure that your family, especially their mothers, you know, are adequately trained to engage in what we call money generation activities. Because it is a known fact in Africa that if you empower a woman, you stabilize a family. So not only we work with the children, of course, to make sure that we are enrolled and maintain them at school and provide them with healthcare, with reinforcement classes, but make sure that their mothers are empowered in a way that they can just help make this, you know, our efforts more sustainable. So we've been doing this for 10 years. It has been really inspiring because you come to a place, you know, first you come, there's nothing, and people are definitely in an utter destitution. And then you create a project, you enroll children, they start being able to go to school, accessing basic health care, the mothers generating some revenues. Then you start seeing that you're making a difference, that you are positively impacting on the lives of people, which is really important. And after 10 years, before I left Child Fund, I had like former sponsored children who became lawyers. Some were teachers, all kinds of professionals. And this is what is really inspired about the work that Child Fund International is doing. Of course, we had problems initially because it was not called Child Fund International. It was called Christian Children Fund Incorporation.
And this was founded somewhere in the U.S., right? The founders?
Actually, the headquarters is in Richmond, Virginia, okay? But the funds will come from the monthly contributions of the sponsors. So if you enroll at least for one project, 1,000 children, you may come up, you know, having maybe like 400 or 300 sponsored. And that money they pay every month is going to be used at the budget for the particular project. Now you have opportunity to, you know, go for, and then now each month you can have an increase or a decrease in the budget depending on the number of additional sponsored children or children who just left the project or some sponsors that may want to cancel. But in a way, it was enough budget to definitely make a difference in the life of the people. The reason why I brought up this is this issue of Christian Children Fund Incorporation. In a country like Senegal, where we have 95% of Muslims, when we wanted to definitely get people more engaged locally, so we had to go for a change in the name to call it Child Fund International. Now it is Child Fund Senegal, Child Fund the Gambia, Child Fund Sierra Leone, to make sure that that religious connotation is taken out.
Okay. So your responsibility for those three countries, right? Senegal, Gambia, and Sierra Leone, you oversaw that.
Yes. Like children are enrolled in different African countries, mainly in those days, Senegal, the Gambia, and Sierra Leone. Later on, we had Guinea added to it.
Okay.
But yeah, now I was working at the WARO, the West Africa Regional Office.
Okay.
So I had at least two countries to supervise. But I directly work with children, with the families. It's a very tedious and time-consuming and meticulous job to do because you have to monitor each child sponsor from different cultures. So this is where I start definitely building some of my cultural competences.
Okay. That's good. Actually, that brings me to another question based on what you said. So I did read some impactful stories on Child Fund and the commitments that you did and the organization did in advancing digitalization and youth empowerment by working with local partner organizations. So some of these partners are obviously local leaders, maybe the chiefs in the community, the priests and what have you, and even family members, as you did mention, and others. Okay. So what are some of the challenges and how will you or can they be addressed? And what are the benefits of these partners in meeting your goals?
So very interesting. You know, when you come to a project first, so you have to do what we call the advocacy. That is, you negotiate with the local authorities. Because sometimes, especially in those days when we had Christian organization, you had to take time and explain to them what are the missions of Child Fund and how Child Fund can help build the capacity locally and bring changes into the communities. And, you know, you have to talk to the leaders, of course, because you know, we have very strong leadership in Africa, in Senegal. Yes. You first yes. convince the leaders throughout meetings and allowing them to visit other projects that we already have in other parts of the country, but also letting them share what they think would be the best way to address their problems.
Yes.
If you come up with just a copy and paste solution, it might not work. Even if you have one, you have to make sure it is adjusted because each place, they have their own needs, they have their own problems and stuff like that. So you first convince the leaders, then you start, and then you talk to women. Because ultimately, when the leaders say yes, you know, the father say yes, okay, but the mother would be more engaged in that because, you know, in Africa, mothers are very close to their children. So you talk to the mother, show them the benefit, allow them to share what they would like to do and what they would like to see happen in their places, in their villages in the next 5 years. And then you take those things into account. And then you do what we call like, you know, a strategic planning. You know, you do your surveys and you do all those things to make sure that you take into account and you definitely mainstream all the concerns of the population in what they would like to see and come up with a comprehensive strategic plan. And then now then you can start. There are some challenges because, you know, when you talk about like allowing one child or, you know, children to be responding with people who are not from Senegal, but from Africa. So it's become really challenging in terms of how these people can influence influence on the children. So you have to make sure that the national office definitely be able to monitor those relationships. Because we had cases of, you know, the shocks, you know, things that might be normal or allowed in the Western countries and not allowed in our country. So this would be the role of the SR supervisor. One of the roles of the SR supervisor is to make sure that when the sponsor sends a letter to his or her sponsored child, I have authority to open the letter and read it.
Okay.
And read it and make sure the content is appropriate before it goes to translator.
So just piggybacking on that, once the sponsor is identified for each child, is there some sort of orientation that goes, like cultural orientation that goes with the sponsor you do for the sponsors, especially if, for instance, if the sponsor is from a Western culture, which might be different from the African culture, do you go through some sort of orientation to understand?
Yes, of course. We would make it something that is personal relationship, but we make sure that we are there to monitor. So we call different stages. First of all, when a sponsor, you know, accepts to sponsor a child, then the child will send what we call a welcome letter.
Okay.
And in that welcome letter, everything that he needs or she needs to know is right in there. You know, in Senegal, we have different tribes. We have the Wolof, we have the Serer, we have the Jola, and stuff like that. So they are in that first welcome letter, there are general information about Senegal and Africa, and then some specific information about the particular tribe, you know, where the sponsor child belongs. So this is a welcome letter. And after that welcome letter, now the sponsor will be responding, also sharing, you know, their values in the Western world. Sometimes they are from America for most of the time, and they can be from France, they can be from Germany and other countries. But in any way, this is the first step. Not only we have those orientation meetings, with the parents, because sometimes children are enrolled at a low age. The earliest will be, you know, like 3 to 4, 5 years. Sometimes even enroll a baby.
So is there a cutoff age for these children? At what age are they?
Yeah.
Sponsorship ends. Is there a cutoff age when they get college or?
Normally, yes. It starts from birth, you know, sometimes up to college, but normally when they are 18. When they're 18 and still going to school and still need some support, we have what we call child future plan.
Okay.
So we have a 2-year plan or 4-year plan that make sure that, you know, the sponsor understands and accept that he has to continue supporting the child so that he can at least graduate from high school or graduate from university. And that's what we call a child future plan. But yeah, this is the age range.
Thank you for throwing insight into a Child Fund International and the activities they've done. Obviously, they're doing great work in Africa and other nations as well. So now shifting to this a CEO of CPM24, a pioneering West African public-private partnership firm based in Dakar and Senegal. For our listeners, can you explain the mission of CPM24?
CPM24 is, as I said, it's one of the first firms dealing with private-public partnership, because in 2014, the government of Senegal passed a law for public-private partnership. We did not have that type of funding mechanism in our country. It was something that was rather new in the country, and a law was passed, allowed the government to bring in the private sector with their own funding through unsolicited bidding or BOOT, build, operate, and transfer, and stuff like that. And it was something that was not really understood by the people, especially business people. So, and I had the opportunity to work with two of the persons who definitely work on, developing that law. So They say, okay, but we need to have some type of education for our people, especially the business people, the CEO and stuff like that. So we need to create this firm so that we can educate our people more. So that's why it was called an incubator, because we were just providing knowledge and skills to all those CEOs so that they can be empowered and have the required skills so that they can capture those contract opportunities from the government through this public private partnership. So this is basically what was the mission of CPM24.
Okay. But, all right. Thank you so much. This all happened under the current administration. You said 2024?
Yeah, no, 2014.
2014, okay. All right.
Anyway, but we have what we call the continuity of,
yes.
Of government business. So this is a law now that was passed 10 years ago. Mm. And, from that particular period to now, many of the infrastructures, highways, bridges, universities were built under that scheme.
That's impressive. Yeah, because many African nations do need a lot of infrastructure, either new ones or improving. Yeah,
and this is one way of just funding those infrastructure through build, operate, and transfer, or build, operate, own, and transfer. Yeah, something like that. We have, different schemes when it comes to the private partnership. But this is really making a huge difference in the development of infrastructure in our country, especially in Senegal.
Nice. That's great. Yeah. So also, you just in 2020, March 2024, Senegal elected the youngest president at 44 years old in their history. Actually, brought waves all over the globe, just seeing President Bassirou Faye elected in 2024. But also in Africa, in May, the African National Congress, which is the ANC in South Africa, also lost majority in parliament for the first time since the beginning of the free elections in 1994. There were other changes that occurred in government in Africa, like in Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso as well. Okay. And also, there was elections in Rwanda, where the president, Kagame, still maintained victory, a landslide victory of 99% vote in his favor. So there have been a lot of debates and discussion. Some will argue that African elections are actually showing democracy and should not be taken for granted. Okay. So what are your views of the future of African countries and democracy? Do these recent elections and changes in government in Africa give hope, or some of them actually raise concerns?
Definitely. I think very promising future on the continent of Africa and amongst the people of African descent, especially, because I think I'm going to tell you why. But to come back to what happened in Senegal, which really was a landmark in our history, because after 64 years of independence, we were able to definitely elect the youngest president of our history, but also the youngest democratically elected president on the continent of Africa.
Yes.
This is a powerful sign, because what is happening is there's a wind of change, across Africa. You cannot stop this change. Young people, they want to take responsibility. They want to take over. They've been just relying on these seniors to do the job, but it never happened after over 50 years now. Now they're taking responsibility and they really mean it. But what is interesting here is, you see, in other countries like Mali, it was done out of a coup.
Yes.
In Burkina Faso, it was out of a coup. Likewise in Niger. But in Senegal, it was democratically done. The people stood up, you know, cast their their votes and brought about this change, which has definitely been impacting positively for the continent. Because in the project, as they call it, with capital P, they sold a project to 54% of the people of Senegal. That's why this was just on, you know, at the first one with no runoff, which is also unprecedented.
Yes.
In our history. And for some people, we're only allowed to campaign for 2 weeks as opposed to three. For some people who from jail went straight to the state house.
And 10 days from.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes. Because as you know, President Macky Sall wanted to push the elections. Some people died. First, he wanted to run for a third term. We said, no, the constitution doesn't allow you to have a third term. He tried to change, blah, blah, blah. But we said, no. And some said that, well, 60 people or 84 people died. But still, he wanted to postpone. And on the eve of the election, less than 24 hours from the beginning of the campaign, he canceled the election. People stood up and said, no, we want our elections. And the main opposition leader, Ousmane Sonko, was arrested and blocked for not to run. But he was smart enough to pick one of his lieutenants, called Bassirou Diomaye Faye, who was in those days in prison too.
Okay.
He's in prison, but still eligible. So he put his name. And then when Macky Sall knew that die is cast, this election had to take place because the Constitutional Court ruled that in any case, you, Macky Sall, you cannot stay in presidency after April the 2nd.
Right.
Even if we postpone the election, you're not going to be the president. So better you make sure we have this election held. And then that was done. And they won. 54% first round, which was unprecedented, which means that this wind of change, people in these African countries will experience it, will execute it in different ways, based on the history, based on the way they usually bring about regime change. In Senegal, we have never experienced a coup d'etat, never. So these regime change just had to go through elections. In Mali, they have been through coups, you know, all along. So it has to, but the vision is the same and the goal is the same. We are going to change the way we deal with France, especially our former colonizers. We want to take responsibility. We want to have sovereignty over our natural resources. But this is the ultimate vision. And this is the vision you have in Senegal, in Mali, in Niger, and in Burkina Faso, and in Guinea.
Yes.
They want to be able, because what happens is you have your natural resources. You go into a contract where it's 80-20 or 85-50, 15% for the government of Senegal and the people of Senegal, 85% for the company.
Yeah.
This doesn't make sense. And then,
yes, that it doesn't make sense. I've questioned that a lot and say, why don't African government use their resources to
live? What they say was, oh, if it's oil and gas, we don't have enough resources and skills to process it, to exploit. But, you know, people like in Qatar, in Juba, they will leverage on those resources to change the face of the country.
Absolutely.
Okay. So now, and this is something we are seeing because of social media. Internet has definitely has pivoted the way African people communicate, the way they see the world, and the way they see themselves in the future. Yes. Because it's real-time communication. So then we need to have the sovereignty over our resources, over our governance, over our politics, so on and so forth. And this is what is happening everywhere in West Africa. Now, depending on people's culture and, you know, ability to organize elections or to bring about regime change one way or the other, they use those mechanisms. So you see, and then this new generation is through what I call, and what we call in Senegal, the generation renewal in politics. And this is what is happening in South Africa right now.
Yes.
Is that because people don't want a ANC? They still want it, but they really want to have young people, you know, take responsibility. And they understand that the only way to do it is to go and vote. And now, by 2050, we'll be 2 billion with over 65% of young people.
Yes.
The youngest continent on this earth. And now the young people are well aware of that power. this power, demographic dividend, people, they do know that they can make changes. And they are the one who really have to make the changes, especially for young people. Okay, we want to be involved in what we think is going to be our future. If we're going to be in charge, just like in Senegal, let us be in all those government bodies, entities, and organizations that definitely are going to decide for the future of our nation. This is wind that is blowing throughout Africa, and no one can stop it. Because as you see, the white or the black man is the main actor right now, globally. You look at what happened with Obama, this was a global thing. What happened with George Floyd, global thing. So whatever thing that's happened to black people becomes like globally televised, broadcasted. So now we are aware that black people are the main actors.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment we realize that we are the main actors, we become powerful because now we're going to use it to pivot things. And
that's a good way of looking at it.
Yes, yeah, sure. We know. We never knew that we were the main actors. We were the one in slavery, colonialism, world colonialism, and all those things in America, in Asia, everywhere you go. But people are starting to realize that we are at the center of all these things that are going on. They want to take our resources from our continent. The same way they took our people to America to enslave them. So we're not going to allow this to happen because we've been to the most prestigious universities.
Yes.
If you go to Senegal, we have one of the most prestigious universities in Africa, especially in the Francophone African countries. And most of our people, they were educated and graduated in France. And they attend the same schools as Macron.
Yes.
I have friends who attended the same school as the current president of France. So this makes us unapologetic. We are unapologetic because we know that we have the knowledge, we have the resources in our continent, and we are the main actors.
Yes.
That was the missing piece. And as the main actors, we have to write our own narrative, and we have to write the scenario right now. And we're trying to write the scenario on the continent Africa, and we want African diaspora, people of African descent, to be well aware of the role that they can play on the continent.
Yes.
It's important. Because if we break up from France, we need to have another option. African in the diaspora can be a good option. And I've been trying to educate people to make advocacy on the fact that we are going to change the way we deal with France. France will not be happy, but regardless, as long as you African people, you people of African descent, people in the diaspora who've got the knowledge, the skills, are willing to come back and take what's yours.
Yes, absolutely. It's impressive to see those change, and especially seeing the young generation getting involved in the political dynamics in Africa. So another thing that I know, like to congratulate you on your recent appointment to chief advisor to the Office of Special Envoy of the Republic of Sierra Leone, Ambassador Walid Samseddine. So in this capacity, you present the interests of many Muslim and African American businesses. Obviously, these offices play a crucial role in strengthening diplomatic relations and facilitating cooperation between Sierra Leone and then other countries, other African countries, and globally. So, how has been this experience so far in engaging dialogue and representing Senegal's interests with other countries, including the U.S.?
Yes, definitely. I think this is what I call my success story, simply because after more than 20 years trying to bridge the gap between Africans on the continent and Africans in the diaspora, especially African-American, and especially Muslims, we always have a problem of representation. You have some business people who are from America, African-American, who like to come and invest and who like to go and do advocacy to talk to their people so that they can come to Africa and invest and help. But the question that is always asked to them is, do you have a mandate? You know people how they operate in the U.S.
Yeah.
Do you have authority to do that? So this was a main problem in what I was trying to do. So I said, okay, now let me see how I can just talk to our presidents, our governments, so they can just see how they can give mandate to credible African Americans or people of African descent so that they can go back home and talk to the people and to build trust. Because my experience in this is that there's a huge gap.
Yes.
In trust. African Americans don't trust African people. We don't trust them either. It's the problem. We look at them, they look like our uncle at home, or our mother at home, our aunt. But when we start dealing with them, we realize, oh, we are different, and we don't trust each other. So the main piece, the biggest piece for me, so far is to build trust. Now, the best way to build trust is to be able to have African-American people appointed at the highest level of government as ambassador at large, as honorary consul, as special envoy, so that they see, oh, these people, they trust our people. They trust and honor people of African descent. They trust African-American. And this is an appointment from the office of the president. That's why this was really unprecedented and helped definitely clear the way, you know, in a way that, you know, I never experienced before. Now, being the chief advisor, so what I do is, of course, we focus on Sierra Leone. Mm-hmm. This gentleman is from the United States. He lives in Atlanta, Georgia. A very successful serial entrepreneur, Muslim brother, you know, hard worker, very inspiring journey. Sierra Leone as a country might not be a market that big companies might have an interest or big investors. So we use Sierra Leone, but we sell West Africa. Because Sierra Leone might be 3 million people, 3 to 2 million people. Senegal might be 17 million. It is still small compared to, you know, market size in America. But when we say, okay, we go to Sierra Leone, but you have the opportunity to deal with all e-commerce, which is over like, maybe like 220 million something people, which is a huge market. So we bring delegations and the investors from America to West Africa. But we have a base in Sierra Leone and an office in Dakar. So before they come, we make sure that they have a clear itinerary and we have a clear idea of what they want to achieve when they come. So we leverage on our relationships, you know, because in Africa, if you have, and this is like globally, if you have one head of state with you, you can connect with all others through him.
Yes.
So you use President Madibio of Sierra Leone. If I want something to be done in Senegal and I have some issues, we can use the office of President Madibio to get the information directly to the office of President Bassirou Diomaye Faye. Likewise, for Cote d'Ivoire, for Nigeria, and all those things. That's why this appointment is really powerful. You don't have to see just for one country, but it's for all Africa, ECOWAS, WEMU, and AU. Because this president can now represent the vision that we have of empowering, giving authority, giving mandate to people of African descent. And this is really, really, really impressive what we would like to achieve. So we advise our governments on how to deal with people from America because they have different standards. And also we advise American people on how to deal with Africa and how to deal with each country in West Africa. And this is where cultural competence comes in. This is where relationship comes in. So this is where credibility comes in. Because what we do is what Dr. Kelechi would call relationship engineering.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. So this appointment definitely aligns with your vision for policies, making sure that Africans and people of Afro origin are considered and actually either elected, appointed.
Let me give you an example.
Decision.
I want to give you an example. Excuse me.
Okay.
African-American people mainly, when they come to the continent, they want to have dual citizenship. Okay?
Yes.
Which to me makes sense. Okay? But they say that you come back home, you should have citizens. You know, right, in a way. Now, in countries like Ghana, they have understood it at the very outset and are making a big difference. Sierra Leone would follow on award, you know, that passport for whoever in the diaspora can prove their origins, like back to Sierra Leone through DNA tests. With African Ancestry and other organizations that are doing the DNA tests, they already passport. But we're having issues in African countries because the type of constitution we have, this French-based constitution does not allow us to do that. But recently, thanks to this work that we're doing, people like me in Benin, in other Francophone countries, Benin passed a law last May to offer citizenship to people of African descent. They can prove that they are from African origin, especially in Benin, just using DNA tests. So now...
So they accepted the genetic tests as proof of...
Yes, yes.
...dual citizenship. You're right. I think Ghana has been at the forefront of the battle of giving.
Yeah. But like in countries like Sierra Leone, it is in the constitution. This is a constitution. If you can prove that you are of Sierra Leone descent, if you are from the Mende tribe, from the Timini and other tribe, Fula tribes from Sierra Leone, you have a constitutional right to have a passport. But it's because those constitutions were made by the people and would not copy it from any other place. But in Francophone Africa, it's more challenging because we have just adjusted the French constitution, which does not give room for the kind of things. Citizenship is either by birth, by marriage, or the president has the discretion over citizenship, whoever he thinks that deserves it. But we've been working to have Senegal, since we have the same type of constitution as Benin. So I said, okay, you were saying that it is only possible and easier to do in Anglophone countries. Now Benin is awarding citizenship, but voting right is not included. The right also to work in the administration is not included. That's fine. Okay. I said, now, since we have the same type of constitution as Benin, why don't we just go and use this example, these things in Benin and pass a law in Senegal? Because I'm almost sure that we have the same constitution at 80-90%.
Right.
For sure. Because this is just the French constitution of the Fifth Republic, you know, of France. Okay. The other thing that we are trying to do, these are how we try to inform policies. Oh, you want them to come and invest, but you have to protect their investment. Oh, they want to now start paying tax in Senegal. So you need to make sure that they can buy a home, they can have a family, they can live a decent life, and they can have a Senegalese passport. They have an option. They are giving us option with regard to France. We have to give them option with regard to America and any other country. So if there are problems there, if they're not happy, they can just, oh, let me use my Senegalese passport and go to Senegal.
Yes.
We have to allow ourselves to have those options.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. I think it's going to take a lot of lobbying.
Yeah, yes, sure.
Legislations to make those changes.
But
it's doable.
Yeah, no. Like, we have what we call the legal mechanism to do those things. EU, in the 13th General Assembly, elected the diaspora as the sixth region of the continent.
Okay.
Yes. And this is an AU resolution.
Yes.
And AU has created what they call the AU passport. It was launched, I think, 2-3 years ago in Kigali, Rwanda. There's an AU passport, which people have not leveraged yet. We have an ECOWAS passport.
Okay. Yes. Why do you think people have not leveraged that? Is it because there's lack of education or what?
It's lack of education, but lack of implementation and execution mechanisms. Because the African diaspora is the sixth region. Recently, I think they had a meeting in London and they put in place what they call the government of the diaspora. You know, I think those type of bodies, those type of mechanisms should champion those things. Because it's right now. So, if we cannot be Senegalese, we can be Africans. We can just accept this AU passport as people of African descent. You know, these take a lot of lobbying, of course, at the highest level, and to see how also some of the organizations here in America and in the Caribbean can have the status of observer at AU level. Yeah. Like Haiti. Haiti is now almost part of AU, you know? Mm-hmm. So we need to have those type of opportunities for our people. So they see themselves in what being done. They see that they are contributing in the development of policies on the continent. This is one of the things that I'm pushing for. It's really, really, really challenging, but it's doable because people, now they want to turn the page from France and other Western countries. They're looking for options. And recently, I hosted an international study workshop in Dakar. It was just how to leverage on the resources in the diaspora. How these people and these resources are, you know, a credible and valuable option for us. We want to turn away from France. That's fine, but let's go and talk to our people. Because whatever resource we need from friends, skills, and competence, we have it in the diaspora.
Yes. So obviously, like you and many others, I have enlightened our leaders to a lot of education and tools that they never had previously. So now when it comes to negotiating contracts or negotiating certain things, our leaders, the African leaders, are able to leverage your resources, and then use those tools in that tool basket, if I should call it that way, to be able to negotiate that. So now the challenge is when they come to Africa and they try to negotiate certain projects, right? They have their own interest. So now with the knowledge that our leaders have, to be able to push back and make sure that Africa is not being cheated in this negotiation, do you think it has the tendency of driving away foreign investors into Africa?
No. They will stay anyway, because this is in their ultimate interest.
Yes.
They need to know what we want. They cannot turn away from our resources. They cannot drop our resources. Look at France. The next day that they had problems with Niger and they stopped this uranium, exportations, they start having blackouts in Paris for the first time in their history, which means that definitely they do need our resources, but they never wanted us to understand and know that these resources are vital for them. They will say, oh, we are coming to help you. Let us help you. Now we know that they are not helping us. They are helping themselves. That's why we don't play when we negotiate with these people, because we know that they will not quit anyway. They will not quit anyway. Now it is our responsibility to make sure that we have the knowledge, the skills, and the experience to negotiate this contract for the benefit of our people. And yes, will not turn them away. Believe me, it will not turn them away. Look what happened in Niger. The French wanted ECOWAS to intervene, but the French are using U.S. military intelligence. It was because of their interests, what they call the U.S. strategic interests. They never want to follow France in that, because they are building a pipeline from Nigeria to Europe, going through Niger. And the contract was awarded to Chevron, a U.S. company. That's why they didn't want to follow France in that intervention using ECOWAS, because this would put in jeopardy their strategic interests. So now we are well aware of all those things. They will not leave anyway. They will not go away. They will stay. That's why we need to look them in the eyes. One, as President Bassey Diomaye Faye said, a more respectful and a win-win partnership.
Partnership.
We have first to respect us, and then you make sure we have win-win partnership. We're not going to allow you to just take and go. No. And then you will want to make sure that these resources definitely are beneficial to our entire population.
And yeah.
And let me tell you something. These people in Senegal, in Niger, in they're not playing.
Yes.
There's a tremendous amount of pressure, but still they want to move forward, because this is the only way to bring about change. So I'm not worried about them going or turning up. No. I'm just worried about our ability to, now that they know that we know, we are able now to negotiate decent contract for our people.
Yes, this is very impressive. And also one story that I've been following is in Nigeria with the whole Dangote oil refinery, which is already a changing point in the oil saga in Nigeria. You know, refining that oil in Nigeria will change the economic dynamics of the country.
Of course.
Yeah.
You can imagine Nigeria, one of the number one oil producers, it don't have a refinery.
Right.
And then prices of oil would just skyrocket every now and then. Whereas the raw material is taken from Nigeria, refined in I don't know what country, brought back to Nigeria, it doesn't make sense. We have the knowledge, we have the resources, and thanks to people like Dangote, with this definitely a game-changing vision to build this refinery. We have one in Senegal, but it's not a big one. You know, but if we have refined in Nigeria, we can just collaborate. If we cannot refine our production in Senegal, we'll take it to Nigeria.
All right. So another thing I wanted to talk to you about on this podcast is your cultural competence and connection at the highest level of West African governments and businesses, right? Including social and religious leaders, have enabled you to actively engage in bridging the gap between Africans on the continent and people of African descent, especially those in the U.S. in the past, which we have talked about as well. So now you serve on the International Steering Committee for the Delaware African and Caribbean Affairs. So how has it been serving on this community and using all the experiences and skills that you bring on board?
It was very exciting, because last year I was invited by Dr. Kelechi and the commission to speak at the symposium. And when I came and I started discussing with him, and that we had the same vision. And I've been touring the U.S. I've been to Atlanta, because my base is mostly in Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay.
I'm a Southerner, as they would call it. But when I came to Delaware, looking at the way our people are able to get into the decision-making process, to have this commission be a state commission, because I know in Philadelphia, they have a commission like this, but it is at a city council with Stan Stoddard and people like that, Jenny Blackwell in the past, things like that. But this is a state commission. I said, okay, then we can leverage on this thing. We can leverage definitely on this thing especially then, Dr. Kelechi and myself, we have the same vision on what needs to be done to bridge this gap. Or the fact that we look like, yes, but we are different. We have to do education. And if we have this connection, this unprecedented connection with the local leaders, with officials, they can look into the governor's office. They can call the mayor. They can call the senator. They can have the idea. This is something that, as people of African descent, we can leverage on and make Delaware a hub. Especially that this project, Global African Center, resonates very well with me and with my vision. So I said, okay, I'm going to now start concentrating on Delaware and on this commission, because this can help make a huge difference. And this is why, then one day after the conference last year, we decided to go more international this year.
Yes.
With Dr. Kelechi, and thank God, thank Allah, I would like to leverage my connections to get Sierra Leone on board.
Well,
you know, with Fiston Bakri, who is also sitting in the committee. Fiston Bakri is the governance coordinator of the State House of Sierra Leone.
Okay.
You know, and then we would like to bring on board the Gambia, to bring on board Senegal, of course, because I'm from Senegal, and many other countries. So I think this, for me, is a powerful tool for scaling up what we've been doing over the last 25 years. And now we have access to political leadership in America through this Global African Center and Delaware African and Caribbean Commission. That's why I've been really excited to work with the commission, to sit in the steering committee and one of the key organizers of this summit, because the vision I have seen here is in line with what I've always wanted to do. That is to be able to leverage, you know, some powerful political instruments in America or bridge the gap, because the government will be more comfortable dealing with a state commission.
Yes.
You know, it's easy to say, oh, this is the Delaware State and blah, blah, blah commission wanted. It's easy. Now you have them easily on board. And then this definitely have helped so far, after 1 year, build the gap, fill a huge gap between Africa and people of African. So this commission for me and this Global African Center can definitely be the place to go when we want to have certain things sorted out at the Congress and the Senate, you know, but also when the U.S. want to come to on the continent, Africa, we can serve as an advisory agent. This is really important. So this is why Delaware for me is really strategic. And this is what we're doing is really strategic, because our people here were able to definitely have their voice echoed.
You know,
what happened in the last elections, when I just got here with those primaries, is really, really telling on how powerful and how impactful our people are and can be in the way this state is run. And at the same time, in the way this state and the U.S. will be dealing with Africa.
Yes, absolutely. So I'm really excited about the Global African and Caribbean Center in Delaware. You know, I spoke to Dr. Kelechi on this some time ago. It's very important for us to have visionary leaders like Dr. Kelechi, who is pushing hard to have this established, because this is a center that will be a good information point for things like the African Union passport that you talked about and stuff like that, you know, just to educate people on that. So one question for you, are you going to be attending or speaking at a tourism fair and economic center this September in Delaware?
Attending 100%, because I arrived, a week ago, just for the preparation, just to help Dr. Kelechi. And speaking, I might be moderating one of the sessions. Attending, yes, 100%, and 100% involved in making arrangements for a successful conference. And I might be speaking or moderating, you know, one of the flagship sessions will be the mayor's forum. We are bringing mayors from Senegal, from the Gambia, from Sierra Leone, and from other parts of the continent, Africa. And I think this is just something that is starting, and we hope that next year we'll have more resources, or again, more time, and like to do more. I think this is just like, smoothing past. We just trying to open the way to very, very big event, make Delaware the hub when it comes to the engagement of people of African descent, because we have this White House Presidential Council for African Diaspora Engagement, you know, and all those things. And I think Delaware can be definitely a place where people can go to what they want to deal with Africa or deal with America, especially that they have the Global African Center, which means international relations, diplomacy, you know, what I call people's diplomacy, economic diplomacy, cultural diplomacy, so on and so forth. And I think this Global African concept is really important. And I think, thank you, Dr. Mujahid, for this concept and, you know, the Global African Group, because to come up with this concept of Global African is really important. Because Africans are everywhere. When you say African with capital A, it should not be those on the continent African. It should be the global African citizen.
Yes.
Wherever they are, in America, in the Caribbean, in Asia, in Europe, in Australia. And this is how we can make things move on the continent and maybe leverage on that EU passport. Because this global African citizenship, if it is put forward and leveraged on, we can definitely have the diaspora accept the EU passport as global African citizens.
Thank you. Yeah, so Mr. Bashir, you are a man of faith. You're practicing Muslim. And how can interfaith dialogue amongst countries and various groups and religions bring about people together and then also create a world peace? We have a lot of things going on around the world right now. You see what's going on in the Palestine, Israel, and then also we have other places in Africa and globally as well. So what's your input on this? I know you've worked with so many groups.
Yes, of course. I'm a first, of course. And definitely my first connection with African-Americans was through Al-Islam back in the early 90s when I was still a student at the university taking English and law.
Yes.
So Islam was my first bridge, my first tool to connect with African-American, especially Muslim people. Mm-hmm. But not only Muslim people, but African-Americans in general. Because when we go to delegations, we don't care about the religion. It's about just this business interest or like just to a homecoming trip or something like that. But this is a powerful tool, definitely. And as a Senegalese, I think we are well prepared and in a very good position to use this interfaith dialogue to bring about peace globally. Simply because for a country of 95% Muslims, our first president who ruled the country for more than 20 years was a Christian.
In Senegal.
Yes.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. The first president of Senegal.
Yes.
From 1960 to 1980 is Leopold Sédar Senghor, and he's a good Christian. And he ran the country for 20 years, was supported by the Muslim leadership.
Right. And for Senegal, it's 98% Muslim, right?
More than that.
More than that.
Yeah. So we never had those issues in Senegal.
Right.
So we don't talk about interfaith dialogue. We talk about interfaith life. But for us, it's not a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yes.
My mother-in-law is a Christian. And I'm in the Muslim leadership. I'm a Muslim leader. But my wife's mother is a Christian. And we do Christmas together. They come for Eid. So these are something that Allah, God, has blessed Senegal. So, and this can be showcased everywhere. So you can do it. It's possible to live in peace and harmony as Muslims, as Christians, as atheists, so on and so forth. And I think that recently, President Jomai Faye, 2 days ago, he appointed, for the first time, a minister dealing with religious affairs to make it more institutional. But we never felt the need to make it institutional because this is our daily life. But we say, okay, in order to be able to duplicate it and to impact more beyond Senegal, we need to make this more institutional. So definitely, I think religion is something that whose mission is peace and human excellence, be it Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and stuff like that. So we need to be able to definitely accept our differences. But when Allah talks to people in the Quran, He must them refer not as Muslims, He will say believers, ultimately all mankind, all human beings. So all those religions, if they are not focusing on human excellence, would be to no avail. So now we need to accept that we can have different faiths, but the mission remains the same. It is human, foster and push for human excellence. And that's why we are very comfortable when we deal with Christian people, Jewish enemies and all that. Because, okay, the first thing we put forward is their humanity. They are just human beings and we need to deal with them as human beings. What is happening in Palestine is really unfortunate, in other countries also, but one of the teachings of in our community, because I'm from the Lion Community, the community of the Mahdi in Senegal, and we don't have tribes. We don't recognize tribes. We don't recognize even family names. That's why they say Bashir Sek, also known as Bashir Lai, is the name that is given to all the members of our community, which literally means God. I'm a servant of Allah. So Bashir Lai, Bashir, the servant of Allah. And whoever in our community had the same name, simply because the family names, for instance, in Senegal or in Africa, would refer to a tribe or upper class. So the Mahdi, our master, wanted to eradicate that. So these are the things that we teach when we talk to other people in other countries, that we all are creatures of God. Mm-hmm. God has brought us on this earth, sent prophets so that they can help us have human excellence, achieve human excellence. So we need to recognize the values in each one of those religions, but we also accept that we might be different in the way we practice our religion, but ultimately the goal is just human excellence. As I'm very much involved in that. I serve as an advisor to many religious leaders, especially in Senegal and West Africa, to open their eyes, because these are Muslim leaders, that we are Muslims, but we need to be able to deal with our Christian brothers, our Jewish brothers, because you and us, we have the same mission, that is to achieve human excellence. We need to sit and talk to each other and accept our differences. Because the Quran says that I have created you in tribe and races so that you can interact. So this is an asset.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, like, diversity should be an asset.
Yes.
Diversity should not be a source of problem. Diversity in the Quran is an asset.
Asset.
It's what can make us interact. So I think this is very important. And these are the things that, because is that sometimes obvious for a Muslim leader in Senegal to know all those things? They can read the Quran and know it, but it takes them some effort to practice it, accept the others. And these are where we come in and advise based on the knowledge that we have of, you know, other religions and our experience working with people from different, you know, walks of life. I think this is definitely one of my passions. I'm passionate about interfaith dialogue, interfaith life. I'm passionate about especially bridging the gap. And when you want to build a bridge, you have many tools. I sometimes use religion when it be. I use economics or economy when it be. I use culture when it be. So you come up with many bridges. As long as you can achieve this goal of bridging the gap between our people, I think you definitely, and religion is really instrumental. Because we even have an issue with Black Muslims, as we call them. On the continent, there's a very negative connotation when you say Black Muslim. Whereas when you look at the history of Al-Islam, of course, after those Muslim slaves, Umar bin Said, and all those things, I think in the late and mid-90s with Noble Drew Ali, and then with Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Master Fred Muhammad, who came up with the Nation of Islam, the nation was not practicing Islam. It was more of a social justice movement. But with the leadership of Imam Muhammad Waruddin, the son of Elijah Muhammad, they're now practicing true Islam. So they cannot be considered just like Black Muslims are the one who are in the nation. They have imams, they have everything. So I have to educate Senegalese leadership, especially Muslim, hey, they are practicing Islam the way we practice it. And I'm a living witness. I spend Ramadan with them, fast. I do Juma with them. I pay Zakat with them. I do this. Already, Bashir, are they praying five? Yes, they pray five times a day. Since 1975, there were a pivot in the leadership in the Nation of Islam. And there was this breaking between Louis Farrakhan and Imam Waruddin Muhammad. Imam Waruddin Muhammad wanted to practice true Islam. I wanted to stay and dwell in the teachings of Honorable Elijah Muhammad. But the community of Imam Waruddin is practicing universal Islam, as the one practiced in Senegal. And this many people don't know on the continent. So these are education, a lot of education, you know, a lot of things, you know, that we were. It's a lifetime mission. It takes you to be passionate to do this work. It's time-consuming, resource-consuming. But when you do what you love doing, you can reach excellence. The only way to become excellence is to do what you love.
Yes.
I'm doing what I love. Thank Allah.
So, yeah, thank you for that. And I know I ask this question to all my guests who come here. I know you have accomplished a lot in your career and in life. And I know you're still pressing on to accomplish more. So out of all these awards that you've got, both professional, civil, community awards, what particular award actually do you hold close to your heart and why? And then also, what is next on your journey?
I think, as I said earlier, the one I definitely consider as a real award is this appointment of the special envoy for an African American. This was unprecedented in the history of African American, to my knowledge, so I understand, as far as I know, and as far as they know, because they told me that this is what I definitely see as being, you know, I've received many awards, but this one is definitely a landmark, is definitely a game-changing, you know, and, you know, award. I consider it as an award because that appointment was for me. And I said, no, I'm not going to take this one for myself. I'm going to use it to build trust between us on the continent and people of the diaspora. So please, let me go and check among the diaspora, a credible can take this job, can take this appointment. I said, really? Are you sure? I said, I am sure. Because I know it will be more impactful than me having it, you know. So yeah. That's why I said that this was one of the things that I really, really, keep close to my heart, you know. And I'm an eternal unsatisfied man. For me, I've not achieved a lot. Maybe you can see, I don't have time. I don't have time to see that. I don't have time to start reckoning what I've done. I only have time for what is next. I only have time for this huge and humongous work that we have to do to bridge the gap. That's why I even forget all about my achievements. I've achieved a lot of things. But if you ask me a question, what have you achieved? First thing, I will not tell you. Because I'm not focusing on that. You see?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not really focusing on that. Because the job is too much for me. So I need to focus on the future. So the next step for me is to push for his global African citizenship. Global African citizenship. I think if we are able to sell it to our people on the continent, it will be a huge win. If you say African Americans is black people in America, Caribbean African, but if it's global Africans, in this way, Africans wherever they are in this world. And this is really important. I have created a 501c3 called Global African Roadway. I'm organizing next year the Global African Summit in Senegal to put those things forward. Because this is where we should go, global African citizenship. Because if you say diaspora is still vague, but global African, even if those in Europe were born in Europe, are global Africans. Those in Asia are global Africans. Likewise, in America, Caribbean, and on the continent, Africa. So my next thing was how to bring that at the highest level of government, at AU level, and at UN level, so Africans in general can be recognized as global African citizens with rights.
Yes, thank you for my. It will be great for participating there in the summit next year in Senegal, and we hope to get an invitation to that as well.
I'll make sure you get one. Yeah, because we need to let you. Because we need to tell our own story.
Yes,
we need to write our own narrative. So far, the story is told by the hunter, not the prey. And I think it's high time that we, as being people being hunted all along, all over, are telling the story. And people like you are helping us do that.
Yes.
It's our voice. There's war on the continent of Africa, but still, there are good things happening on the continent of Africa, and we need to echo those things. It's
yes.
Real.
Yes.
That's why we always would like to thank you and encourage you and support the work you're doing. I've been very busy. I was even at thinking that I could make it for this show because of the things that I have to do. But definitely, when I look at the script and I saw you in my mission. We need to have people with different skills.
Thank you so much. So finally, how can listeners connect with you and your work about empowering Africa? Can you share any maybe social media profiles? And what's your final message to our audience today?
Yes, to reach me, I'm on Facebook with Mubashiran Lahi. I'm on TikTok with BLS Send Gateway, because Send Gateway is a company that I incorporate in America to do the work, you know. And yes, I think you can reach me my Facebook page. My email is bashirlai@yahoo.com. Also, and we're working on the web on website, which we will be sharing, very soon. And my last message would be to all people of African descent, including Africans on the continent. Our differences is our power. Our differences is not weakness. It is a powerful tool. Because if we come up with this global African culture, and if we refer African culture as all those different cultures that our people, as Africans, people of African descent, were able to develop and create wherever they are, on the continent, Africa, in America, in the Caribbean, in Asia. If this is what we call African culture, we be aware of that. This is a powerful tool to achieve and accomplish our ultimate mission, which is to take over this planet. We will take over this planet for sure. But we need to work hard on it and recognize our differences and take them as a tool, as an asset, as something that is enriching African culture with capital A. Thank you.
Mr. Bashir, I would like to thank you for making time and sharing your great and inspiring stories and accomplishment on this platform. I believe it will go a long way to uplift people's continents. As Winston Churchill said, attitude is a little thing that makes a big difference. I hope to bring you back soon on this platform, more especially to highlight the summit in Senegal, give you an opportunity to further share more accomplishments with our audience. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I appreciate your time. Hang in there. Keep the good work you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you. To our listeners, a big thank you for staying tuned with us. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Uplift Chronicles. And please leave us your feedback on our social media platforms. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Uplift Chronicles. I hope you found inspiration in today's stories and the spirit of upliftment. Remember, every life has the power to inspire change, and every story is a thread in the rich tapestry of our shared heritage. If you enjoyed this episode, kindly subscribe and leave a review, and share it with someone who could use a little upliftment in their life. Follow us on social media for more updates and join the conversation. Until next time, keep uplifting and stay inspired. Signing off, this is Kofi Dake.